I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's July 25th, and we have a lot to talk about. Experiencing difficulty walking is one of the most common mobility challenges faced by people living with MS. You might walk unsteadily, you may trip or stumble, and all of that leads to you feeling less confident in your ability to get where you need to go. The good news is that there are things you can do, both at a PT facility with a physical therapist and by yourself at home, that can improve your mobility. Joining me to talk about walking difficulties, fall prevention, how to manage problems with your gait, and what experts are learning from the latest research in this area is the Director of Research for the Department of Healthcare Sciences at Wayne State University School of Medicine, Dr. Nora Fritz. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Fritz, there are a few other things that you should know about. The primary benefit associated with being on a disease-modifying therapy for MS is that your DMT will slow MS progression, and that means maintaining a higher quality of life for a longer period of time. But it may not be the only benefit of staying on your disease-modifying therapy. A Canadian research team analyzed the health records of 35,984 people living with MS in four Canadian provinces, focusing on how many times over a 22-year period each of these individuals was hospitalized or visited a doctor for any reason, whether it was related to MS or not. The research team divided these 35,984 people into two groups, those that were using a disease-modifying therapy and those that weren't. And they divided disease-modifying therapies into two groups, first-generation DMTs and second-generation DMTs. First-generation disease-modifying therapies included Avonex, Betaferon, Plegridy, Rebif, and Copaxone. Second-generation DMTs included Tysabri, Gilenya, Tecfidera, Aubagio, Lemtrada, and Ocrevus. And the researchers discovered that, compared to no use of a DMT, using any first-generation disease-modifying therapy was associated with a 24% reduced risk of hospitalization. Using any second-generation DMT was associated with a 29% lower risk of hospitalization. The research team not only analyzed these disease-modifying therapies as a group, they also analyzed the difference in the risk of being hospitalized for each of the DMTs. And those differences ranged from an 18% reduced risk of hospitalization among people on Aubagio to a 44% reduced risk of hospitalization among people on Gilenya. While the use of disease-modifying therapy had a significant association with the number of times an individual might be hospitalized, there was no association between any specific DMT and the number of times an individual might visit their doctor. So the outcome of this analysis provides what seems like one more very good reason to start on a disease-modifying therapy and stay on a disease-modifying therapy. It's going to reduce your total number of trips to the hospital, and that's one more way of preserving your highest quality of life. If you'd like to review the details of this study, I'm going to include a link to a friend of the podcast, Sharon Roman's blog, titled Tremlett's MS Research Explained, where you can read a plain English report of this study. And for those of you who want to dive a little deeper, I'll also include a link to the published study itself in today's show notes. Despite evidence to the contrary, stem cell therapy is often thought of as an almost magical cure for MS. While some forms of stem cell therapy have been shown to be effective treatments for some people with MS, how does the outcome of stem cell therapy stack up when it's compared to outcomes from high-efficacy disease-modifying therapies like Gilenya, Tysabri, and Ocrevus? That was the question on the minds of a large research team that included scientists from 20 different countries, including the U.S., Canada, the U.K., the Czech Republic, Italy, Turkey, Portugal, Tunisia, and others. The research team reviewed the comparative effectiveness of each of these treatments in 6 specialized MS centers that offered autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, or AHSCT, and an international MS registry in the years between 2006 and 2021. The analysis included a total of 4,915 people living with highly active relapsing-remitting MS who had been treated with AHSCT, Gilenya, Tysabri, or Ocrevus. 167 of these individuals had received AHSCT, 2,558 were treated with Gilenya, 1,490 had been treated with Tysabri, and 700 had received Ocrevus. The researchers matched up the demographic profiles of the individuals who were studied, but noted that the individuals in the group that had received autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation were generally younger and had greater disability than the individuals in the other groups. So let's look at the results. Compared with the group that received Gilenya, the group that received AHSCT experienced fewer relapses, a similar risk of disability worsening, and a higher chance of disability improvement over 5 years. Compared with the group that received Tysabri, the group that received AHSCT experienced a marginally lower number of relapses, a similar risk of disability worsening, and a higher chance of disability improvement over 5 years. And compared with the group that received Ocrevus, the group that received AHSCT experienced a similar number of relapses, a similar risk of disability worsening, and a similar chance of disability improvement over 3 years. Also, of the group that received AHSCT, there was one AHSCT-related death. The research team concluded that in preventing relapses and facilitating recovery from disability, AHSCT was superior to Gilenya, marginally superior to Tysabri, and there was no difference in its effectiveness compared to Ocrevus over a shorter available follow-up time. The results of this study don't by any means disqualify AHSCT as a viable treatment for some people living with MS. I think the results illustrate the fact that AHSCT is exactly what it is, a viable treatment and not the medical equivalent of magic beans. Now, I know many of you have a real interest in autologous hematopoietic stem cell transplantation, and if you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. When we talk about living with MS, we often focus on managing symptoms, but it's sometimes important to consider how those symptoms themselves may actually trigger other health-related issues. For instance, a research team from Iran analyzed 56 studies related to sexual dysfunction in MS that were published between 1996 and 2021. Now, the majority of these studies were conducted in Iran, while some of them were also conducted in other countries. And the researchers concluded that compared to healthy women who were not living with MS, women with MS were 3 times more likely to face problems with sexual intimacy. The research team estimated that 61%, almost 2/3 of the women living with MS, were or would experience some level of sexual dysfunction, with low libido or low sexual desire affecting almost half of these women. Neurological damage due to MS can have an impact on the physiology of sexual arousal, but low libido can also result from experiencing other MS symptoms like fatigue, pain, bladder or bowel dysfunction, depression, anxiety, or other psychosocial factors. Now, these studies included questionnaires designed to assess sexual dysfunction, and the researchers found that 48% of the almost 9,000 respondents complained about low libido, 40% cited arousal problems, 32% identified decreased vaginal lubrication, and 29% reported a lack of orgasm. 27% of the women in these studies were estimated to be satisfied with sexual intercourse. The research team noted that various studies that they analyzed had defined sexual dysfunction differently, and so the results between the 56 studies showed a wide variance. And while the individual study results may have shown a wide variance in defining sexual dysfunction, there seems to be little doubt that this is an issue that affects a large percentage of women who are living with MS. And since 2/3 of the people living with MS are women, this is a topic that needs more discussion between patients and their doctors. Sexual dysfunction is something that women can and should be talking about with their neurologist or MS care specialist. But like any other topic associated with sex, cultural taboos can get in the way. This isn't a condition that anyone has to settle for or feel embarrassed about, so please don't. Your healthcare provider is ready to help, and if this isn't something that they're asking you about, you should feel comfortable bringing it up to them. If you'd like to review the details of this research, you'll find a link in today's show notes. There's a conversation taking place in the MS community around whether adults living with MS who are over the age of 65 need to continue their disease-modifying therapy. This isn't a new conversation, but for many physicians and their patients, it remains an unsettled conversation. Now, there's plenty of evidence that shows that disease-modifying therapies are effective among people living with MS. That evidence comes from clinical research. But people with MS who are over the age of 55 are rarely, if ever, included in clinical research. We also know that as an individual ages, the activity in their immune system slows down. So when you think about MS as a result of an overactive immune system, this change may be an important one for older adults with MS. And as people age, they're likely to develop other health conditions. So when an older person with MS is experiencing some sort of symptom, that symptom may be caused by a different health condition, or it may simply be a function of aging, or it could be MS. The MS population is continuing to age. Those DMTs and high-quality healthcare mean that many people living with MS are living longer than previous generations. All of this makes understanding what aging with MS is all about a research priority. In episode 255 of Real Talk MS, Dr. John Corboy joined me to discuss this subject. Dr. Corboy was the principal investigator in DISCO-MS, a clinical trial that focused on the impact of stopping MS medications in older people. And now, the Population Health Outcomes and Pharmacoepidemiology Education and Research Center at the University of Houston College of Pharmacy has announced a study to answer this recurring question. Pharmacoepidemiology may be a new term for a lot of you. It refers to how medications are used in the real world and how those medications actually affect patients' health outcomes. In this study, researchers will review 10 years of data from Medicare, looking specifically at MS patients age 65 and older who have a history of using disease-modifying therapies, and those MS patients age 65 and older who stopped their disease-modifying therapies as they got older. And the research team will compare the outcomes of members of these two patient groups. The study is being funded by a $1.2 million grant from the Agency for Healthcare and Quality, which is a part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and we'll keep you updated as news from this study is announced. One example of something that might be a symptom of MS or could simply be a function of aging is walking. As we age, we all walk slower. So when an older adult with MS begins to walk slower, it's trickier to determine why they're walking slower. Walking is one of the most common mobility challenges for people living with MS at any age. And in a moment, we'll be joined by my guest, Dr. Nora Fritz, who's here to share the steps you can take to improve your balance and your mobility. Difficulty in walking, also known as problems with gait, is one of the most common mobility challenges in MS. Gait problems may cause a person to walk unsteadily, they might trip or stumble, and they may end up feeling less confident in their ability to move around. Joining me today to talk about walking difficulties, fall prevention, how to manage those problems with your gait, and what experts are learning from the latest research in this area is Dr. Nora Fritz. Dr. Fritz is an associate professor in the physical therapy program in the Department of Healthcare Sciences and Department of Neurology, as well as a director of research for the Department of Healthcare Sciences at Wayne State University School of Medicine. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Fritz.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
To start us off, can you give us a definition of gait and explain what parts of the body contribute to our gait?
So gait is just another way of saying walking. And I know we usually think about walking as being mostly a lower extremity or leg driven movement, but really we rely on the whole body for successful walking and gait. If you think about all these different systems that contribute to walking, we really need strength in order to walk. We need the nerve signals to conduct the information to our muscles. We need coordination and timing for smooth and energy efficient walking. We need sensory function to understand where our limbs are in space. We need postural control of our trunk and balance. And we use our arms to swing and be a little bit more energy efficient in our walking. We rely on our vestibular system that's in our inner ear for balance and to keep our head steady during walking. So there's all these systems working together to ensure smooth, coordinated walking.
What are the common gait problems that people living with MS might experience?
So if there's an impairment anywhere in those systems we were just discussing, there can be difficulty with walking. In MS, some of the most common issues are related to strength, sensation, and balance. And those tend to manifest as slower walking, maybe asymmetrical walking, where we don't spend the same amount of time on each side, more time with both of our feet on the ground during the walking cycle, shorter step lengths, and maybe poorer walking endurance. So that is, I can't walk as far in one go as I used to.
What factors contribute to gait problems among people with MS?
So anytime there's an issue in one of these many systems that we talked about, there can be problems with gait. So if we think about what happens in MS, there are lesions throughout the central nervous system. So that would be either the brain and or the spinal cord. So that tends to result in some variable presentation among different individuals with MS. And if there's lesions in, let's say, for example, the spinal cord, that could cause problems with strength or sensation in the lower extremities in the legs. And so that could contribute to that person's difficulty with walking, for example.
Can gait problems be temporary or are they always permanent?
So I think that is a challenging question. It depends, I guess, is the answer. And my physical therapy students always get mad when I say that, but that is often the answer. It depends. In this particular case, if the reason or the primary driver of the walking dysfunction is, for example, a strength-related issue, or if, for example, the individual doesn't walk much during their day, they sit for their job, they're mostly inactive, then there could be an element of deconditioning layered on top of a strength problem. And so in that case, if we walk more or exercise more and do some targeted strengthening, may actually see improvements in walking. Or, for example, if someone has a lot of fatigue and that really impacts their ability to walk longer distances, targeted aerobic and strength training programs, which have been shown to improve fatigue, might allow for a change in walking. So I think the take home there is that some changes can be temporary and you can target them with specific training to improve over time.
When we're talking about gait, we should also talk about falls. There have been several studies that report between 50 and 70% of the people living with MS will fall at least once within any six-month period. Why are falls so common among people with MS?
So as we were just kind of talking about, these lesions throughout the central nervous system can cause different kinds of impairments like balance dysfunction or walking dysfunction or changes in sensation. And all of those together contribute to an increased risk for falls. Layered on top of that are some other common impairments experienced by persons with MS, like fatigue or spasticity or changes in cognitive functioning, which can also contribute to falls. So there's this cocktail of all these different impairments kind of coming together that increase someone's risk for a fall over time.
How does falling affect someone both physically and psychologically?
So physically, we think about injuries that might result from a fall. But also what we know is that someone who experiences a fall tends to become a little bit more inactive after the fall. So they're a little less physically active. And that really contributes to deconditioning. And over time, becoming less active and more deconditioned can lead to declines in strength, can lead to declines in balance. And so this can become sort of a self-perpetuating cycle where a fall leads to an increased risk for more falls as a result of being deconditioned. We've also seen that falls are related to increased social isolation. So people tend to leave their houses less or see fewer people, have reductions in their mental health as a result of falls, or even develop fear of falling, which is just a specific anxiety related to falling, which leads to becoming more and more inactive.
Are there some MS medications that might serve to decrease someone's risk of falling? And I'll ask you the flip side of that question as well. Are there other MS medications that might actually increase someone's risk of falling?
So I'll start with a disclaimer that the medications are not my area of expertise, but I'll tell you what I do know, which is there was a 2015 paper that came out looking specifically at this question and showing that some antidepressant medications like SSRIs were linked with an increased odds of falling in MS, but that the disease-modifying therapies were actually linked with a reduced odds for falling, a 48% reduced odds for falling, which is a pretty impressive number. So that suggests that taking a disease-modifying therapy might actually reduce your odds for falling. And there's been a lot of discussion about a particular drug for walking called dalfampridine or 4-aminopyridine over time. And I think what's not clear is its direct relationship with falls. So we do know that in some people it helps with improved walking, but I don't know that there's been a study specifically linking it prospectively with falls over time. So my general kind of consensus here is that it's important to speak with your healthcare provider, your prescriber of these different drugs about their potential impact on falls, and also any interactions that there might be between different drugs that you have who are prescribed by different providers. I think sometimes, you know, one provider doesn't always know what the other one is doing if they're in different healthcare systems. So that's the advocacy on your own behalf that's quite important.
Besides taking a disease-modifying therapy, which is certainly something everyone living with MS needs to be doing for a variety of very good reasons, are there other things that someone can do to reduce their risk of falling?
Absolutely. Having a healthy lifestyle that includes regular physical activity is a good place to start. If you are not ambulatory, that might include just sitting less and standing more, if possible, practicing transfers, practicing standing over time, setting goals around standing or stepping if you are able to walk, use that pedometer or that step counter that's on your phone or your watch to set goals around getting a little bit more activity each week. That will really help to combat this deconditioning. The next thing you can do is to start exercising intentionally, and set goals around exercise. So in addition to just being more active, also do intentional exercise that includes strength training, balance training, and aerobic training. That's the kind of training where you get out of breath. If you can, you start exercising before you have balance or fall, before you have falls or balance problems, but that's not always possible. So you can start by just becoming a little bit more active. And of course, I'll always recommend asking for a referral to see a physical therapist for specific strategies. PTs are by nature detectives. We want to figure out what are the drivers of the problems that you're having and give you targeted exercises to combat them. You have to follow up that PT session with regular exercise and working with a trainer if that's something that appeals to you.
Despite careful planning, if someone does take a fall, are there any strategies to help reduce their risk of more serious injury?
Absolutely. So being more active is actually a good way to reduce your risk for injury with a fall. So you have a little bit more reserve, so to speak, if you did have that fall. You can certainly work with a physical therapist on how to fall, which is largely related to how you land, but also to relaxing your body during the fall as opposed to tensing up. Certainly easier to say than to do. And that's why it requires some practice. You would also want to work on strategies for how to get up off of the floor if you did have a fall and landed there, because that's important too.
You've led a lot of interesting research about fall risk and detection, including some studies that compared forward walking and backward walking. Tell me, what have you and your team learned from those studies?
Well, I'm always happy to talk with you about our research. We have been studying backward walking quite a lot in the last couple of years as a potential outcome for falls in MS. And a lot of people will ask me, why should we care about backward walking, or how did you come up with this? And it's a couple of different reasons. Number one, most falls happen in the backward direction. So if you think about how the fall occurs, a lot of times it's happening in the backwards direction. The second reason is that we actually do quite a bit of backward stepping in our daily life. So we, every time we back up to sit down in a chair, back up to sit on the toilet, open the refrigerator door, open any other kind of door that you pull toward you, you're doing a few backward steps. What we don't do is sustained backward walking. So walk across the room backwards. So it is this sort of novel task.
How will the outcomes of these studies impact future assessments and perhaps treatment for people with MS?
So what we are finding is actually that backward walking speed specifically is the best discriminator between whether someone is a faller or a non-faller. So we did this study where we explored backward walking compared to forward walking to understand if we could do a little bit better job of predicting who would be a faller than what our currently available measures are. So that's things like forward walking speed or some kinds of balance tests. And we were able to show that backward walking speed better differentiated fallers from non-fallers, which was great because it's easy and quick. It doesn't require any special equipment to do clinically. So we're doing some more studies now to try to understand how best to use this in the clinic.
You know, untreated gait problems can lead to emotional distress, physical injury, added fatigue, and reduced independence. So let's spend a couple of minutes talking about strategies to manage gait problems and treatments that might help. To begin with, what's the first thing someone should do if they notice their gait or their balance is off?
Well, I'll always say the first thing you should do is ask for a referral to physical therapy. Physical therapists come in different flavors. So you wouldn't necessarily, for example, if you tore your ACL, go and see a neurologist for that. In the same way, you wouldn't go and see an orthopedic physical therapist for an MS-related fall problem. So there are neurologic physical therapists who are familiar with this and would be a better person to treat your issue. You can find a list of these folks on the American Physical Therapy Association website, apta.org/find-a-PT. And if you're in a part of the country where there aren't major medical centers or specialized physical therapists, my recommendation is always to call the area their physical therapy places near you and ask who sees all the patients with neurologic issues, because there's always one, and that's who you should go to for your therapy. So that's the first thing when you notice your walking imbalance is off.
What types of exercises might a physical therapist recommend to help someone with gait problems?
So your PT is a detective, and they will try to figure out what is going on. What is the driver of this walking or balance problem that you're having? And they'll prescribe exercises that are related directly to that area. So if it's strength, you'll get strength training. If it's balance, you'll get targeted balance training. More often than not, it'll be some combination of systems. And so you'll get a combination of exercises.
Are there things that people could do at home to address their gait problems?
Absolutely. So starting with working toward a more active lifestyle is definitely one thing you can work on. We've talked about that. Setting goals for yourself related to walking and standing, that can be a really good place to start. And then engaging in regular exercise that incorporates strength training, aerobic training, balance training, and flexibility. These are the recommended areas to meet the guidelines set up for people with MS.
Are there devices or equipment that can help improve someone's mobility and their ability to move safely?
There are. So there's a variety of different kinds of devices. I think we typically think about things like canes and walkers, and that we sort of differentiate between whether someone might need unilateral or just one-sided support versus bilateral, two sides or two hands. And a lot of people are sort of resistant to using assistive devices, one, because it limits what you can do with your hands and your arms, but also it can be a challenge to load them into your car and move around in different spaces, that kind of thing. So I think trying out different devices is actually a really great place to start. And your local physical therapist, again, will have many of these different devices there so you can try them out. I tend to think about the benefits of using devices during exercise as a really good place to start. So using a cane or a walker or even hiking or trekking poles during your exercise, if you're doing a walking program, might allow you to walk further than you could without them. So it might improve your endurance during your exercise or allow you to work at a higher intensity level or higher heart rate level. So that's a really good place to start. The other thing is to think about your actual mobility with the device. So if I'm going to prescribe a walker, I like the walkers with four wheels that have casters on the front wheels. They're better for turning. You can maneuver through grocery stores or tight environments over uneven ground much better than other kinds of walkers. So having that conversation with your PT can be quite helpful.
Well, Dr. Nora Fritz, thank you for all you do to improve the quality of life for people living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/308. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And I want to leave you with one last reminder that this Saturday, July 29th, I'll be in Napa Valley, California, attending Crush MS. Crush MS brings some amazing wineries together to raise awareness of MS and to raise funds for MS research. I'll be there with an MS research update, but you really want to be at Crush MS for the wine, the food, and the music. If you can get yourself to Napa, California this Saturday, I can't think of a better place for you to be than at Reed Family Vineyards for Crush MS. You can get more information and buy your tickets to attend at crushms.org. And Kevin Reed, the man behind Crush MS, told me that if you're living with MS, you'll get a deep discount on that ticket price by emailing him at info@crushms.org. Kevin also told me that every Real Talk MS listener can get a 10% discount on the price of tickets by including the discount code RealTalkMSDiscount. Now that's all one word, and the R is capitalized. You can check out that discount code in today's show notes to make sure you have it right. I always love connecting with members of the Real Talk MS listener community. So if you find yourself at Crush MS this Saturday, I hope you'll stop by and say hello. You'll find the special Real Talk MS discount code and a link to get your tickets for Crush MS in today's show notes. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.